We are so excited that you are here to listen to the Script Cake Podcast.
Go ahead. Make my day.
We want to help you develop your idea into a great screenplay, and who knows, maybe you'll write the next big blockbuster.
So you're telling me there's a chance?
Yeah!
Well, there's always a chance, but let's not get ahead of ourselves. Are you ready to learn about screenwriting?
Yes, Will Steinberg!
All right, then. Let's get started. Enjoy.
Okay, hello. I'm Chris Vogler, author of The Writer's Journey, and I am honored today to be a guest interviewer with my friend and colleague, Lavinder Gill, who is a very, very prolific and dedicated to many things. I know him basically as a teacher of screenwriting, one who has won awards for being the most inspirational teacher. And I'm sure that's well-deserved because everything I could see indicated this was a guy who really was going to take everything he had learned at great cost and share with everybody else. Lavinder has a wonderful, generous way about him. So we're interviewing today on the occasion of Lavinder taking his wonderful ideas and putting them into the form of a book called Script Cake Secrets, which I think relates to the title of Lavinder's blog and also, you know, is a metaphor for how he looks at what goes into screenwriting. So hello, Lavinder, and look forward to having a great conversation with you today.
Well, I'm happy to be here and excited to have you to talk to. So, yeah, looking forward to it.
Well, let's just dive in. You know, as I look at your biography, one thing stands out that you are on the move a lot. You are a citizen of the world. You have a very interesting background. And I see that you've traveled quite extensively doing documentaries in exotic places and teaching all over the U.S. in just about every region. So why don't you tell us a little bit about your background and how you arrived at this? I want to kind of drill in on your initial movie inspirations and so forth later, but just generally, what's your background and how did you get here?
Well, I'm a first-generation Indian American. And like all good Indian kids, I was trying to choose between, you know, being a doctor or being an engineer. And I remember I was a pre-med my freshman year of college, and I was in a class called invertebrate zoology. Mm. And about halfway through the term, I realized I could not spell the name of the class, so I should probably not be in this major. And at the time, you know, in the back of my mind, and I think most people that work in this industry, feel the same way. You always knew this was what you wanted to do. But it just seems like such an unattainable career. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? Because, yeah. You know, most of us don't have friends or family that work in the film industry. We have people that have 9-to-5 jobs and, you know, work regular hours. And it just seems so unfathomable that one could have a career in such a field. I remember when I wanted to change my major, the way my credits transferred, they went much easier into a broadcast journalism major than into a film major. And I will give my father a lot of credit here because he was the one that actually told me to change my major. And this was Christmas break senior year. And it added like an extra year and a half for me to do that. But he knew I wasn't happy. I had changed engineering and he knew I wasn't happy with it. And he's like, if you're not happy with it now, son, you're not going to be happy doing it for the next 40 years.
Very wise.
So I went into broadcast journalism. I got my degree. My first job out of college, I was a reporter for a very tiny little station in North Carolina. And it was a lot of fun being recognized by people and going out and doing your thing. But after a few months, I started to see this pattern. And do you remember the thing called Mad Libs when we were kids, where we would just fill in an adjective or a noun or whatever? Well, for me, that's what being a reporter kind of became. Blank team won blank game against blank other team by this many points. Blank player, you know, you know, had these stats and so on and so forth. And it just kind of became a repetitive thing for me. Whereas the first few months it was all new and it was kind of a slow death because, you know, thinking of oneself as a creative, I wasn't just wired for that. A lot of people are wired for that and God bless them. It just wasn't me. And fortunately for me, the person who directed the commercials for the TV station had taken a job somewhere and they needed someone to step in. And I just volunteered. And now instead of having 3 hours to do a 30-second spot, you know, that you do on the news every day, I had 3 weeks. And I could think about my shots and I could think about writing the script and I could think about all this stuff. And as soon as I did that, I'm like, oh, this is where I'm supposed to be. And at that point, like I said, I was in North Carolina at a brand new film school called at the time it was called the North Carolina School of the Arts. Now it's called the University of North Carolina School of the Arts, a school of filmmaking. And I was accepted into the third class they ever had. And a lot of talented people in my class that are just killing it right now. Craig Zobel just directed that wonderful series with Kate Winslet this past year that shot in Philadelphia. Danny McBride. So many other people that are just doing so well from that class. And even the class before that and after that. Very driven, very focused. The school was amazing. And I got to do an internship in LA for Bedford Falls, which is one of my favorite companies. And then I went straight to grad school. Because one of the things I realized after my time in LA was that it didn't matter if you were a directing major, a screenwriting major, a producing major. If you're in LA, you're developing a script pretty much across the board. And because, you know, they have directors and producers and whatever. What they don't have were a lot of great scripts. And so that's kind of your way in. And so when I came back, I'm like, that needs to be my focus. And I went on and I got my MFA in screenwriting at Hollins University. And the first script I wrote in grad school got me an agent. And it was later on made. And that got me my first paid gig. And that's how it slowly started. And once I had a master's degree, I was eligible to apply for teaching gigs. So having had a few films under my belt, as well as my MFA, the first job I had was at East Carolina University. And that's where I happened to win the Most Inspirational Faculty Award, which was a big blessing.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, this is very interesting. You know, I see some parallels because I also followed the journalism, you know, the first few steps of my journey was along that broadcast journalism path. And then I, you know, took some side roads and got into the Air Force and made documentary films for them. And that, you know, opened the door of my mind to this other possibility. So I relate to that. Although, don't you think that the broadcast journalism was helpful, as it was for me, as a good background? Because you are telling stories as a journalist.
Absolutely. You know, for example, writing, when you write the news, you write actively, you don't write passively. Right. And so my writing is very clean just from that background.
Yeah.
You know, the skill set you get as a journalist also comes in handy as a teacher, also comes in handy as a director. You're using the same tools, that's cameras right. and lights and things like that, just not quite using it the exact same way.
Right.
Just because news has a time limit on it. You know, here's your assignment. It needs to be on the 6 o'clock news. Go. And you have a few hours to do something as opposed to, you know, making a film. They'll be in development for years and years and years. And so absolutely, I think it had a massive, massive impact on my career.
Yeah, yeah. It was helpful to me, you know, because you have to tell the story very concisely and with a hook. So the article might be a boy fell in the lake and somebody rescued him. That doesn't sound like a big deal, but the guy who rescued him was blind, you know, so you've got a hook into the story, and it definitely helped me that way.
Yeah, there's a lot of times where there isn't a great hook, and you've got to kind of create one and find a way to draw people into the story. And so, yeah, you know, some of the times you're doing really exciting stories, and other times you're just covering the opening of a new hospital wing or, you know, farm day at the local elementary school and things like that. And so, yeah, you definitely got to find those nuggets, which comes in handy, especially during the screenwriting process.
Yeah, you need something to bring those humdrum stories to, you know, a more urgent kind of life. I want to ask you, this is now reaching back, sort of reaching over the biography, back to real deep origin stuff. You mentioned that you always kind of knew that was a world for you, the world of movies and storytelling and so forth. But I'm curious what movies or genres sort of lit you up as a kid. As it was for me, maybe made you feel, I want to be part of that. I don't know why or what role would be for me, because I don't know all the technical things of who's a producer and who's a director, what those words mean, but I know I want to be in there. So what movies or types of movies?
So one of the movies that, you know, really hit me deeply was a movie called The Big Blue, directed by Luc Besson. This is before he made The Fifth Element and so many other great, fantastic films, The Professional. And it was just a movie about this guy who competed in diving. And I don't mean diving and flipping. I'm talking about going out in the middle of the ocean and seeing how deep you could dive without oxygen.
Right.
And there was a moment, because I was already in film school when I saw this. Uh-huh. And it's one thing to go to film school. It's something else to decide, are you going to dedicate your life to this or not? Because there's always, I think God tests you. There's always options that are made available to you when you're clear on what you want to do. They'll just dangle something on the other side. So, you know, what about this? And what about this security? And what about
guaranteed, that's very true,
income? Yeah. And what about this? And in The Big Blue, at the very end, I hate to ruin it for you guys, but I love the movie, but I'm going to tell you about how it inspired me. After a dear friend of his dies, in the middle of the night, he goes out to where they do these things, and they have this rope that just goes straight down to the bottom, not to the bottom, but deep in the ocean. And they have an apparatus that just kind of pulls you down. And usually there's a doctor at 100 feet down checking your vitals and all this other stuff. And he just goes all the way down to the very end of the rope. There's this beautiful shot of him just floating and holding onto the rope with one hand, you know? And metaphorically, that's how I felt like I was doing in my career. I was holding on to like reality and a real job and, you know, not ready to let go. Mm-hmm. And earlier in the movie, he sees a dolphin, like at one of these little places where you go pet dolphins or whatever. And he can sense the dolphin was unhappy. So he and his buddy kidnapped the dolphin and set it free in the ocean. So fast forward to the end, he's sitting there, and he lets go of the rope. And my heart sank. I'm like, how do you do that? How do you just let go? And a few minutes later, I think it's the same dolphin. They all look alike, comes and gets him and takes him back up to the top. And that was a big moment for me thinking, oh, I can let go. I'm going to be okay. And so a lot of moments like that with different movies. I remember when The Western by Clint Eastwood, with Morgan Freeman.
Unforgiven
came out. And after the movie, the person I was with was like, oh, what a horrible movie. And I'm like, are you kidding? That's going to win Best Picture. And then it won Best Picture. And I'm like, oh, maybe I have a clue as to what's going on here. And so I hadn't developed that passion for, you know, foreign film and independent film because I hadn't been exposed to it yet. You know what I mean? Exactly. But there were these little blips here and there going, okay, you have an idea. Maybe you can do this. And keep in mind, my brother's an attorney, my sister's an MBA, my other sister's a PhD. And, you know, there's a lot of expectation in Indian family and education and whatnot. And so it was nerve-wracking to just let go and just say, you know what, this is my passion. I'm going to go do it.
Well, as you were describing the scenes, I could tell that they still have an emotional charge for you. Mm-hmm. I could detect, you know, that this is something that's still alive in you. And I think it is wonderful to realize that movies often operate for the general public as something like oracles that will maybe randomly overlap with some question or problem in your life and will seem to be speaking directly to you,
mm-hmm.
As if the thing had been created just for you. And, you know, that's a feeling I had reading scripts for a living. Most of the scripts I read were never going to get made. They're just, you know, the slot, the mail slot to deliver a script all the way through to production is very, very narrow, and it's moving all the time. So it's very hard to get anything through. But I sometimes felt that the writer was speaking directly to me, and maybe for one page or two lines, they handed over to me something that I needed.
Mm-hmm.
And so I always was careful to try to communicate in my reports, there's something here.
Right.
You know, it's not for us. It's not for right now for this studio. But please tell the writer that they've done something important, and I wish them luck.
No, so, I feel the exact same way. I think that not just movies, but music and art and paintings and you know, all these wonderful art forms are designed to help us. I think in the book I say, you know, art is medicine for our souls.
Yes, yes.
And I connect that way to it at a young age. And I hope that, you know, the stuff that we're touching and making is helping other people in the way that these things help me.
Yeah, really. You know, there are many motivations for why we get into this sort of work. Making money, being famous, but I think it has a lot to do with the impulse to be helpful or useful.
Mm-hmm.
I certainly feel that very strongly. Now, something is emerging here that seems to be a theme running through your work, and as I look at your book manuscript, I see it a number of times, which is operating through metaphors. You know, that scene you described of the rope and everything else, that's a metaphor. And I believe this is sort of my mythological orientation, that every script is taken by the audience as a metaphor for their own lives. And if they can't plug themselves into that metaphor, that story is no good, or
right.
It's not for them. And people will either lean in going, oh, this is informing me about myself, mm-hmm. or they'll back off and go, I can't relate to these people. But you use metaphors quite a lot from the title of the book and your blog on down.
Mm-hmm.
So maybe let's just talk about that for a second, about the use of metaphors. I see you do that in teaching quite a lot. So what's your thought about that?
No, I mean, I think that's one of the big keys to storytelling, is making metaphors make, you know, things that are probably not easy to swallow palatable. So if I can tell you something that you really need to hear, if I tell you straight, you probably don't want to hear it. You know, it's like talking to your kids. They don't want the straight lesson in their face. But I think metaphor is like, you know, candy coating. And it makes the pill go down a lot easier. And so, yeah, with the title of the book, Script Cake, that's absolutely a metaphor. Because when you look at a cake, you're looking at the icing. You don't actually see the cake.
Right.
So sometimes it's the cartoon character that makes you buy the cake because of your kid or whatever. Sometimes it's like, oh, that chocolate looks really good. But you don't actually know if it's a good cake until you bite into it. And so I make this very clear distinction in my book between a concept for a movie and an actual story. Because a lot of students that have never taken any classes and understand screenwriting may not know the difference. And so they think, you know, the first thought is, you know, hey, you want to write a screenplay? Oh, I'm going to write an action movie. Or I'm going to write a horror movie. Or it's about this, you know, crazy tech device.
Uh-huh.
And I'm like, okay, but there's no story in any of those things that you just said. Those are just kind of, you know, conceptual ideas that are not developed. And a screenplay is a lot like a cake. Like if the icing looks fantastic, I'm probably going to buy the cake. But if I bite into it and the actual cake tastes horrible, I'm going to hate that cake and, you know, say horrible things about the people that made it probably. And so you have to have both. You have to have this kind of, you know, concept that people want to see. And that's what the metaphor is with the icing for the cake. And then you also have to have this really nice, moist, wonderful cake. And it's really hard to create an icing shell and fit a cake that's going to perfectly fit underneath it. And that's how everyone thinks of movies. They think of their concept first, and then they're like, oh, like I'll just stick a story in here somehow. But if you do it the other way around, if you bake the cake, which is how everyone makes an actual cake, but if you bake your story and really figure out your story and then decide what your icing is going to be, which is your concept, the two work hand in hand perfectly. And so metaphorically, I think, you know, people are doing it backwards. You can't come up with a metaphor without having a point to it. You have to have a point, and then you think of the metaphor that works with it. The same thing happens with screenplays.
Yeah, you know, it's a mechanism I think that's helpful to people, because it's saying you already know how this works, the subject that you've chosen to be the metaphor for the thing you're actually talking about. But you know how this works. You know how a cake is made and ice. And so transfer that over to this other thing, making a story, communicating with people. And metaphors are rich because you can sort of hand it over to somebody, and then they'll go on developing it and think about, well, what kind of icing and how do people decorate cakes? And also backing up, well, how is the cake itself made from these ingredients, from sugar and butter and flour and some eggs and milk and a little vanilla and some salt and all these things that if you just pile them up on the table, wouldn't they just be piles or a puddle? But when they're combined correctly in the right sequence and so forth, then they come together and become something else, bigger, greater, more wonderful and delicious, chemically changed and so forth. And so here I am exploring, even going beyond the metaphor. And that's a wonderful thing, that that it sort of empowers people to think in a different way and transfer over all that they know about that. You know, you use a number of metaphors in your book, which is wonderful, by the way. It's sort of a catalog of the most common mistakes. And I get asked that a lot when I'm speaking or being interviewed. What are the most common mistakes people make? And you did a great job, I think, of corralling the primary areas where people get off the rails on the first step. You know, almost everything you're talking about is a mistake made early in the process, which if you could get out in front of it or think differently about it, you'd be better off. But you use one sort of package of metaphors. It has to do with the human body. And I'd like to hear a little bit about that. You talk a lot about the parts of the body and how they relate to each other and how they all have their different jobs. And that is a kind of metaphor as well for the storytelling process. So how does the body enter into things for you?
So, you know, when you start taking screenwriting classes, like I did, you basically find this kind of catch 22 that you have to deal with, because you learn a three act structure and you learn when the first act break is and a second act break, and all these things have to be in certain places. So your script kind of has to be identical to almost every other script there. And yet it also has to be completely unique and different. And it's like, well, how do I make something that's exactly the same as every other script that follows this exact same structure, but also make it unique and different? And I struggled with that for a long time.
Sure.
I couldn't see how that was possible, because, you know, if I'm going to make a action movie, it's going to have a chase at this point, it's going to have a this at that point, and how do I make that completely unique and different? And so at one point, I realized that my hip bone connects to my thigh bone, and it's as most people do. You know, we all basically have the same exact structure. We might be a different height or a different width or, you know, slightly different, but all the bones are all working the same way. They're connected. Structurally speaking, we're pretty much identical across the board. Okay. 90% of humanity, I would say. And yet we are all completely unique, different individuals. And so a screenplay is the same way. Structurally speaking, it kind of has to have these structural points in there. And even people that haven't studied screenwriting, they've seen 1,000 movies in their life. So they basically have, you know, digested this process. And if your first act break isn't roughly where it's supposed to be, the movie's going to feel like it's too long, or the movie's going to feel like it's too short. The movie's, you know, the timing is off. Something's not going on. And they don't like it. They don't know why. They can't quantify why it is.
That's right. Yeah.
But it's because structurally it's not there. Now, if we take the metaphor even deeper, inside of your body, there's a lot of stuff going on. You have a respiratory system and a cardiovascular system and a muscular system and so on and so forth. And all of these things have to work together. Well, your screenplay has to have all those things too. You know, one of the things I talk about is a secret ingredient, which is kind of the heart of your story.
Right.
Okay. And that pumps the blood throughout the entire story and makes sure everything functions the way that it's supposed to. But, you know, if you create a character web, if you have certain characters, that's like, you know, your circulatory system. If you have, you know, emotional elements that are kind of going through, you know, your story in a different way, that might be your cardiovascular system. And all of these systems have to work together well. I mention it this way. A screenplay is a lot like a human body in the fact that if you see someone attractive, that will draw you to them. And it doesn't mean they're a supermodel or whatever. They could be attractive for any one of 1,000 different reasons. Okay. But generally, we're attracted to the exterior of a person. But it is not until we get to know the interior of a person, who they are, what their value system is, do we realize, can they be my friend or my lover or my spouse or something like that? So you're attracted to the outside, but you fall in love with the inside. Mm-hmm. And that's the exact same way you have to design your story. Conceptually, it's got to be interesting enough and attractive enough for me to spend $12 or $15 and put my butt in a seat. But if I watch it and the inside is hollow, I'm just not going to like it.
Yeah, I have a way of saying this, which is they come for the spectacle, you know, whatever the big effect or the concept or the world or, you know, you're going to see Tom Cruise hanging off of a helicopter, you know, all those sort of superficial but exciting, wonderful things. Mm-hmm. But they come in for the spectacle, but they stay for the lesson. And some people don't like to hear that they're being given any lessons, but I think we're talking about the same thing, which is something emotionally meaty, something that causes you to reflect on your own situation, mm-hmm. Something that is emotionally real and useful to us in kind of interpreting our own lives. And I notice you use a word, which I also use, organic, to cover a lot of this territory we're talking about. To me, that means that when I was analyzing scripts for the studio and reporting on them in the meetings, I noticed that I was different from the others. The other executives responded to things in a numerical way, like this will appeal to the 44% demographic of the young adults, and this will probably do $15 million in the opening weekend and so forth. Very, very sort of mechanical, scientific, numerical approach. And I just pointed to the organs of my body. So I realized there was something about this idea. The movie, the story should be organic. It should arise organically, which means, you know, loosely, it means in a natural way. But I think it's more specific than that, that it actually has to interact with the organs of the body and cause them to respond to the story or become involved in the story. So my heart is pounding, my chest is constricted, my throat is choked up. You know, there are these different real things happening in the organs of the body. So when you say organic storytelling, what does it mean to you?
Well, it definitely means everything that you're saying, you know, like clench. Sometimes I'll notice that my fists are clenched really tight during a tense moment in a movie, or I'm holding on to the handrail or something, or I'm on the edge of my seat and I'm leaning forward. Like, you know, there's a lot of physicality that's involved in that. Yeah. But I take it back, you know, kind of pre-actual writing. I take it to development because, again, the majority of the biggest issues that I see happen before Fade In is written. Mm-hmm. Okay. If you're trying to write a screenplay that's a concept and has no story, pretty good chance it's not going to work out very well.
Right.
Okay. And so I just look at the way things kind of grow organically in the world.
Right.
For example, you plant a seed, you nurture it, you water it, you love it, it grows into its final form. If it's a tree, it grows into its final, you know, magnificence. If it's a human, we start with a seed as well, and then we grow into whoever we're going to be, how tall we're going to be, what color we're going to be, what shape we're going to be, how much hair we're going to have. That's, you know, after the seed is planted and is nurtured and is grown. And then going back to the, you know, the metaphor for script cake, if you write your concept before your story, it's not organic because you're trying to fit a story within a concept. Does that make sense? And so,
well, I certainly have dealt with many. In fact, I've co-written or come in to rewrite something that was composed that way. And if you have this consciousness of, you know, needing an organic spine to the story, it's a nightmare to be dropped into something. You know, sometimes I would parachute in on a heavy concept-driven story. And realize nobody had any idea what the theme was. Mm-hmm. You know, what is this really about as a human issue? There was no consideration of the backstories and the histories of the characters and why they were the way they were portrayed. And so all of that had to be brought in and reverse engineered. You had to go back and kind of take the cake apart in order to put all that in. So much better to do it from the initial conception and approach it that way.
Yeah. Now there are times where you were hired to do something. I was on a call earlier today for a project and this is what the end product is. Okay. But I've got to figure out how to grow it into that product. Yeah. And you know, like I wrote a movie years ago, eventually became a movie called Lost Stallions, A Journey Home with Mickey Rooney in it. And I was given criteria. Here's this, this, and this. And I'm like, okay, it was on a horse ranch. I don't know anything about a horse ranch. At that point, never been to a horse ranch. And so like zero experience. And so I'm trying to wrap my head around it. And I just stopped and I go, okay, what am I dealing with right now? What can I write from that is just, you know, right in my heart and something poignant that I can actually, you know, bring some gravitas to. And I was still dealing with the loss of my mother. She had died a couple of years earlier and it was a big struggle. And so I just thought, I'm going to write a movie about dealing with loss. And the beauty of that is it's very cathartic for me as well. Mm-hmm. You know, so as an artist, I got to process it and deal with it through my writing. And so I wrote a story about a young boy whose father dies. And he starts to act out and steals cars and gets in trouble. And eventually a cop hands a brochure to this woman about this horse ranch. And the kids don't know that it's a horse ranch for, you know, kids kind of with emotional issues. They just think they're going on vacation for a week. And so he gets there and right when he gets there, a horse dies and he bonds with that horse's offspring and they kind of connect in an emotional level. And eventually that horse runs away and he goes back to get it. And so he goes from people that's stealing cars and doing things that are irresponsible to actually trying to go do something that is responsible and evolves as a human being. And, you know, we have a couple other kids that also are reflections of what's going on with, you know, his issues as a kid who's adopted. Okay. Which also goes back to my, you know, issues with losing my mom. Like, okay, who am I? And who's going to help fill that void in what shape, way, shape, and form, and so on and so forth. And so I'm writing a movie about dealing with my mom's death, but everyone else sees the icing on the cake, which is it's a movie about kids at a ranch with Mickey Rooney in it, who's known for his horse movies, National Velvet, Black Beauty, and whatnot. And one of the great screenwriting moments I had in my life was I was on stage at the School of the Arts, my alma mater, with Mickey Rooney, and someone goes, "What made you do this movie?" And it just looks over at me. He goes, "The script." And that was just, life.
Oh, great moment, man.
Yeah. And the beauty of it is, it was a very successful film for this company, and they offered me half what they paid me for the sequel to this movie, and I said no. And so they hired someone else to write the script, and Mickey Rooney wouldn't do it. He said no, because he just didn't have that story, you know? And I think anyone who's been in the industry long enough sees that you have to have it. You have to have a great concept that's, you know, going to make people want to come see the sizzle. And you got to have that emotional story, which helps me evolve and learn something as a human being.
Yes. And it's interesting that you seem to have identified with that one, something that you could almost cook down to one word, which is, I think you could say, loss. That it was about the loss of a parent, loss of the world that he grew up in, then, you know, attaching to something and losing that and trying to get it back again. So I feel sometimes that's a key moment, either in the deep in the process or at the beginning, where you sort of stake out, well, what's the one human issue or quality we're going to deal with? In the case of one of these concept-driven things I worked on to do rewriting, I just wrote blindly for about 70 pages, trying to struggle through and all the time fishing for what is that one word. And I noticed I kept typing different variations of the same idea. I don't trust you. He doesn't trust me. Our government doesn't trust us. I don't trust our government, and so forth. And then I went, aha. And I stopped and I went back to the very beginning of the script, and I made sure that trust was in every scene. And that's from what I gather, that's one of your principles, is to try to tie the story together by methods like that, where you you apply the same acid every time in every scene, almost in every shot.
Absolutely,
you're trying to get the same taste in it or the same energy, and that unites a script. And in it's one of those things that, again, as you said, people don't know why, but they just they know if it's not there, and they know something's wrong, and they can't tell you why. Or they know when it is there and they can't tell you why. But, you know, that unification of a script is valuable. So let's hear something about that.
No, I mean, it goes back to the cake metaphor. If you take one bite of a cake and it tastes one way, and you take another bite of a cake and it tastes a different way, it's like, what's going on? This is wrong. Well, the same applies to, you know, your movies. And so I don't take it all the way down to one word like you do, because I'm not at your level. But I always say, once I know what my secret ingredients is, and basically, what is this movie about? I use that in a sentence or a few words.
Right. And
that's a measuring stick. And every scene has to support that throughout.
There you go. Yeah. This is a really good set of tools, or I would say sometimes a knife to cut with. Because, you know, as a young storyteller, filmmaker, screenwriter, you have high ambitions and you want to put everything you know into it and every thought you ever had, and you can't. So you have to have some knife by which to cut out the excess and just focus on the stuff that is essential and will make it feel coherent. So that's that questioning all the time. Does this serve my basic idea? Does this enhance it or develop it or challenge it? You know, does it do something with that essential secret ingredient you keep talking about? So I think maybe we could dive in a little bit on some of these common errors that people make.
Sure.
you know, your first thing you talk about is a concept-oriented script. And I think we've touched on that already, but what does that mean in your frame?
So there's, you know, two parts of movies that people that want to make movies deal with, the concept and the story. Okay. A lot of people don't know that the two separate things. So I'll have a lot of students come in and go, oh, I'm going to write this horror movie about this killer blank, you know, or it's going to be this chainsaw thing, or it's going to be this, you know, it's not a chainsaw. It's a hatchet. So it's different. And I'm like, okay, well, what's the story about? And I remember years ago, I was teaching as an adjunct, and I came in and taught to teach a class called Screenwriting 4. So the kids had already written a screenplay, and the Screenwriting 4 class was a rewriting process. And so my first lecture was the difference between story and concept. And mind you, they spent, you know, three semesters writing their screenplay, and a girl raises her hand and she goes, I don't think my story has a story. I'm like, well, that's the first step towards moving towards where, you know, you can add that in. And a lot of them just did what I think many screenwriting teachers do, which I think is a great disservice. Here's a three act structure, go find something that fits in it. And that's kind of all you're left with. And I think that's where a lot of these mistakes happen. Okay.
Yeah.
So the first thing you got to understand is there's a story and there's a concept, and then there are two different things that work hand in hand together.
You know, that's been expressed. Somebody, a great theorist of drama, said it this way, that the concept maybe is the queen died and then the king died. But the story is the queen died and then the king died of grief. Mm. So that, you know, there's an emotional development within it. And, you know, you start to feel something more. I mean, you feel a little something for two people dying, but when you know that one loved the other and misses them, and, you know, it was so bad to lose someone that you actually died over it, that's now approaching this idea of a story. So,
right. I think a lot of students will look at these things and think I'm trying to get them to write a drama.
Uh-huh.
Because I keep talking about emotion and emotion and emotion. I'm like, right. Absolutely not. You know, there are wonderful horror movies that have incredible emotion, action movies with incredible emotion. There's a movie that came out a few years ago called Warrior about MMA fighting. And I'm the last person on the planet. So the sizzle didn't work for me. I don't need to see MMA fighting. So I never saw it in the theaters. And then one night I was bored and it was on HBO. And so I threw it on. And by the time the movie ended, I was bawling. Because it was, MMA was just this shell within which this incredible story about brotherly love was being told. And, you know, I have a brother who I love dearly, and it just really connected to me. And I just about lost it at the end. Yeah. And I remember when I was, before I ever went to film school, I was watching this karate movie with Eric Roberts called The Best of the Best. And it became like a 5 or 6 series movie. But again, just watching it alone in my room one night, just trying to kill some time. And at the end, I'm bawling. Mm-hmm. And that's how, you know, it was definitely a B movie that was made, but it was made so well, it got 4 or 5 sequels because they crushed it the first time because it actually told a really powerful emotional story wrapped in this world of you know, karate, Olympic karate teams, and things like that. So absolutely, if you write a story that has no emotional beat, you are writing scenes that have no point. It's right. Just stuff happening for no reason.
Yeah.
You know,
in martial arts, they talk about something called empty form, which is not desirable, so that you're doing the moves and you might be doing them very precisely and fast and so forth. But if your spirit mm-hmm. is not in it, the viewer can tell. The observers can.
I mean, the metaphors go across all platforms. Like if you see someone make an amazing play in a sporting event, whether it's basketball or tennis or football or hockey or whatever, you know, they do something spectacular that you didn't expect. Wow, that took a lot of heart. Mm-hmm. Heart is what we're talking about. It's about emotion. It takes that as well as the athletic ability. You know, you look at someone like Michael Jordan, mm-hmm. athletically super gifted. Was he the most athletically gifted person in the NBA? No. there were plenty of other people that had equal or better athletic ability than he did. But it was the internal stuff, the right. will, the determination, the focus, the passion that made him who he is, you know? Even to this day, I was just at a basketball tournament this week with my son. All the kids were wearing Air Jordans.
Yeah.
Hadn't played for 20 years and they're still all wearing Air Jordans, you know? It's that kind of an impact. The same thing applies to your screenplay. Conceptually, yeah. have a great idea, but if you don't have that amazing, emotional, impactful story that is told with passion, it's just not going to go anywhere.
Right. Yes. Michael Jordan may have wanted it more than all the others who had maybe better abilities than he did, but something in there was driving him. So you talk about your second of you have 10 mistakes that people make commonly, and I sure recognize them. But one of those is writing from the outside in. And that sounds like it might be related to the concept versus story idea. So what's
the exact same thing? So if conceptually you come up with an idea, I'm going to write this story about this, you know, FBI secret case, something, blah, 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 that you're making up. You're basically creating a shell. Okay, let's look at this, the icing for the cake.
Right.
And now you have to find some modicum of emotion. And I'd say more often than not, you know, it's like, oh, it'll be about this person and their kid. And at the end, they'll hug and it'll be okay.
Exactly. That's what I see is that they reach, there's like a shelf above the screenwriter's desk where they reach for the most common, the most obvious, the most cliched thing. That he didn't show up for his daughter's recital.
Right.
And so she's always this, and he's got to prove somehow and rescue her or whatever. And that's deadly and, you know, something to be avoided by going about it the other way, as I think you're suggesting.
Right. So if you're writing it from the inside out, like I said, that one particular story was about, you know, the death of my mother. Mm-hmm. I got challenged to write a horror movie, okay, by a friend of mine years ago. And it's not something that is my main genre or what I normally gravitate towards. And so I'm like, well, what scares the hell out of me? And at the time, it kind of goes back to the idea we just talked about, but from a different perspective. I had a daughter. My son hadn't been born yet. She was 2 or 3. And the only thing in the world that scared me is if I lost her in some way, shape, or form.
Right.
That's what I'm writing about. That's it. It's about me and the extremes that I would go to save the one thing that is most important to me. Now, it ended up being this, you know, almost Christian horror vampire movie, you know? And then as I started writing, I started realizing about bloodlines, you know, which is the connection to me and my daughter as well. And so the story started evolving in that direction. Okay. I'm not a super religious person, but I think after I had children, you know, I probably became a little more focused on, you know, that realm because I found something in the world I loved more than myself for the first time. Right. And, this whole Christian, you know, I'm not even Christian, but this whole kind of Christian storytelling element seeped into it because I'm trying to instill a value system, which is what religion is in many ways, shapes, and forms, into my children. And so all of a sudden, all these different layers of things are happening in my story that never would have happened if I just said, hey, I'm going to write a vampire movie. Okay. So I'm writing about something that's near and dear to me. And as each scene progresses, there's a little piece of me in it. And one of the things I mention in the book a lot of times is Hollywood doesn't need your script. Okay. They have, I mean, probably 80,000 were registered last year in the Writers Guild, or maybe 300,000. I don't even know what the numbers are. They need fantastic stories. Okay. They need you to write only what you can write. For example, there's a new Star Wars movie being written. There's probably 5,000 more experienced, more credentialed writers that are in line before we are. What they need us to do is write stories only we can tell.
Ah, yes.
And that starts by finding a story kind of within yourself that you want to say, and then you can put it in any genre. You know, if you look at these huge blockbuster movies, when they get it right, like Top Gun is killing it right now, the Maverick movie, not just the nostalgia, not just the quality of filmmaking or the performances, it's got a great story. Okay. And it connects us and it bonds us. And we're like, ooh, I can relate to this character, or you can relate to that character. And so writing from the inside out is not limiting your options. Imagine if you had a tree that you wanted to grow. Okay. And you planted it, and then over it, you put a shell. And the tree is now forced to, you know, try to grow with a shell above it. It's not going to grow right. It's going to come in some weird shape. It might not, it might even die if it doesn't get enough light. Right. And now you've imposed this idea on this tree, and it has no longer, does it have the option to grow into the potential that it once had. You're limiting that. Okay. The same way we talked about, you know, forming your icing first and then trying to get a cake inside of it. It's the same concept, but if you grow it from the emotional idea and let it grow and evolve into it, wonderful things are going to happen. And conceptually, these stories are going to evolve in ways that you never thought. I have, you know, dozens of ideas for screenplays that conceptually become something that I never imagined they would be. Okay. Now, if I had imposed that on the movie before I started, there's no way it gets to where it got to.
Okay. Yeah, I relate to this tracking back to what we were talking about with, you know, knowing what your story is really about, what the theme is. And I caution people not to be handcuffed by this. In other words, on day one, you decide, I think my story is about trust or loss or betrayal or friendship or family or some, you know, human thing like that. But I caution people to be flexible about that and to say, that's it for today. And I may find that it's different. The story may stand up and develop its own spine and bloodstream and so forth. And, will sass you back and tell you, no, I'm not about love. I'm not about trust. I'm about, loyalty, you know? And, so I caution people to be aware that the story has something to say about it too, that it's an organic creation. Yep. And related to your own subconscious, which is working. You want it to be working in the creative process. So I ask people to, you know, keep an open mind about that. I'm jumping around a little bit, but one of your intriguing ideas to me was the mistake of not writing a visual story. Mm. And I feel very, very strongly about this. At one time, when I worked for Disney Animation, they decided that the best writers for animation would not be animators, not artists, but TV writers, because they were funny. Because they were hiring people out of comedy writing. Well, that was fine, but the problem was they did not think visually. They solved all the problems with dialogue.
Yep.
And so in consulting on a, you know, animal script about a panther or something, a cheetah, the cheetah would be trapped by the bad guys, and they would have a 10-page argument. And I would say, well, he's a cheetah. Why doesn't he just run?
Right.
And then you get a chase scene and action, and you can still do all that dialogue, but they'll do it on the run over their shoulders and, you know, in and out of trouble. And it would be more cinematic. So that's what it means to me, but I'd love to hear your thoughts on writing a visual story.
Sure. I think kind of the default setting for most novice screenwriters when they think about writing visually is a fight. That's visual. It's an action sequence or a chase or something in that regard. And, you know, that's not inaccurate, but there's so much more to it.
Yes.
And there's an example that I use from the movie Gladiator in the book. And I may have talked about it on some other podcasts as well, but early in the movie, You see Maximus talking to Commodus's sister. I forget her character's name. In the middle of an encampment before they're about to go to war. And they're just standing there talking to each other. But in the background, there's this very visual bonfire that's being burned. Okay. And it's a dialogue scene. You know, they have to get certain exposition out at the beginning of the movie. But something about that sticks with you, the way it's framed and the way it's shot. Mm-hmm. And then later on in the movie, you find out that they used to date before they married other people. And somehow you knew that. But it's never stated previously in the movie. Right. But you go back to that scene and you can literally see the fire burning between the two of them.
Yes.
Okay. And so from a visual standpoint, it's just understanding emotionally, what are you writing in this scene? What is it about? And how can I visually show that? Because they could have had them just sitting in a tent talking, or they could have had them somewhere else talking. And I just recently saw the new Thor movie, Love and Thunder.
Right.
And there's a wonderful scene where he sees his ex-girlfriend for the first time, you know, during a battle. And he's just like blown away by how amazing she is because she's now the new Thor. Right. And in the background between them, like a 50-foot building explodes into flames as soon as they see each other. And it's the same beat, but comedically used. You know what I mean? Take it to the extreme.
Yeah. I was thinking about Gladiator, and I've often cited the visual thing they did early on, and then they came back to it later, where he is in a sort of memory sequence or dream sequence, and he's walking through his land back in Spain, and he just runs his hand along the top of the sheaves of wheat.
Yep.
And it expresses, without any dialogue needed at all, this is a man of the soil. He yearns for that. He wants to get back to that. That's heaven to him. And, you know, it kind of threads in and out of the story and really ties it together. And it reaches you on a nonverbal level. So mm-hmm. I think that's one of the strong things about.
Well, if you look at the moment right before they go to war, mm-hmm. he bends down and grabs dirt and yes. smells it and rubs it on his hands. And he does the same thing when he goes to fight in the auditorium. And so in the Colosseum, actually. Right. And so I think it's definitely something that they, you know, the writers, the director, the actor came up with to really ground this character and make him a person of the soil. So I love the way that you said that.
Yeah, but it's a kind of poetry. I did a very deep analysis of Titanic, and that was one of my conclusions, is that James Cameron is a, you know, great filmmaker and, you know, great technician and a real good storyteller and all these other things. But one of the things he excels at is that he's a Celtic poet of the old Irish bard and Scottish storyteller tradition. And they use a lot of visual metaphors, mm-hmm. and they help tie the story together, and they give it another dimension or two, which is really desirable. Hitchcock was great at this too, that he would find something to symbolize what the characters wanted or needed, some object that they were after. It really helps to create this feeling that it's all a design.
Right. So a lot of novice writers will just think in terms of, you know, what needs to happen in this scene and move on. And I want them to think about, what are you saying emotionally?
Right.
What kind of conflict can you come up with to get that across? Because a conflict doesn't have to be two people fighting. It can be someone not being able to get the top off of a jar. That's a conflict. Right. Jar is winning. Okay. But it reveals that this person is either physically weak or inept or, you know, gives away. So what information do I want revealed? What is a conflict that I can use to do that? And then how do I express that visually? So there's these kind of layers of thought process that go into it. But, you know, a lot of people, when they're writing a scene, is, I'm like, why are you writing that scene? I don't know. It just felt like the next thing to write. And I'm like, that doesn't qualify. You know, it might be right once in a while, but that doesn't actually qualify it to be the next scene. It has to be this evolution. And so if you can base it in revealing emotional information, then I think it can be imperative. So in the book, I talk about symptoms. All right. So you know, when you have some kind of ailment, you go to the doctor, they identify a bunch of symptoms and they deduce that you have this issue, right? We as screenwriters, that's how we're actually working our movies with our audience. The audience will go and they'll watch scene after scene after scene. And they're just kind of trying to put the puzzle together and figure out what the story's about. And you have to give them a little piece every time. So as a writer, we have to reverse engineer that. So I will take something and look at it as an emotional wound. Okay, this is the issue. What are the symptoms of those issues? The symptom is this, 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 and this. You know, I talk about the original Tobey Maguire Spider-Man movie, the very first one.
Yeah.
You know, he's irresponsible. So the very first scene you see him, he's late for the bus, which is a symptom of irresponsibility. Nothing is said. Okay. And it's entertaining because there's conflict. The conflict's between him and the bus is pulling away and winning. Okay. And if you can come up with enough symptoms for your emotional wounds, that's like the first half of your script, because half of them are showing symptoms so the audience can go, okay, symptom, symptom, symptom. Oh, you know, and you're not consciously aware of it, but subtextually you're aware of it. And then you get to heal the symptoms one by one. You show them just showing up for time in a scene. And that ties back to the previous thing where he didn't show up on time. Right. And then, you know, you show him being successful at something that he wasn't successful early on. And all of a sudden your character is evolving. Okay. And so, yeah, every scene's got to be some aspect of emotionally what you're trying to say. And then visually come up with entertaining ways to show that.
Yeah. You know, I worked for the producer of the original Spider-Man movie, Laura Ziskin, when she, before that, was at Fox. And she made a big thing about scenes needing to carry a lot of weight. They have to do a lot of work. Mm-hmm. And the screenwriter first thought is, I'm just going to reveal a clue, or I'm going to give some atmosphere, or I'm going to give you a little character touch, or I'm going to advance the plot or raise a question or something like that. And she would say, all of the above, plus, 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 yeah. That the scene has got to carry a lot of weight. You talk about pointless scenes. Mm-hmm. You talk about unnecessary characters. You talk about missing structural elements. Mm-hmm. And I think all of that kind of goes to encouraging people to think in depth about their writing and realize that, you know, the first impulse is to do, you can barely manage to just do one thing to reveal a new piece of information or raise a question. But, you know, what we strive for is getting that depth and lots of jobs being done.
Mm-hmm.
Go ahead.
It's a layered process.
Yes.
You know, it's not one thing that you write and that's enough. Mm-hmm. He's absolutely correct. It's got to have all these different layers that are going on so that you're being, you know, I like to think of it as sleight of hand, like a magician. Yeah. They're showing you the magic trick and you're watching that and they're picking your pocket while they're doing it.
That's right.
Well, we're doing the same thing with a movie, with the visuals. We're, you know, enticing you, but we're giving you all these additional layers of emotional storytelling that are going on that are actually manipulating how you feel.
Right.
Okay. It's our job as screenwriters to manipulate our audience. We need them to laugh when we want them to laugh. We need them to cry when we want them to cry, and we have to lead them there. But if I told you it's about a laughing and crying movie, you're not going to go see it. But if I tell you it's about, you know, this Marvel superhero or this great, you know, horror action, you know, period, whatever, that'll pull you in. And then I want to go on this emotional journey. And you do that with layering each scene.
Yep. I like this idea that it's emerging organically, but there is a personal aspect to this, which you touch on your point number five, which is a mistake of not having a voice. And that may be something to talk about with all these other considerations we've been discussing. How do you make it your own and create that unique, or what do you mean when you say that you should have a voice or develop a voice?
So, you know, as someone who teaches and also works in the industry, I get to talk to a lot of production companies and managers and, you know, agents and things like that, often trying to connect my students to people as well. Mm-hmm. And, you know, what's the most common thing? What are you looking for? And they always say I'm looking for something different. But if I go to the movie theaters, they're not, because it all looks the same. Okay. And I'm like, what do you mean different? And they're like, well, they have to have a voice. And I keep trying to break it down. Like, I'd love to have a one sentence. This is what a voice is. Okay. But it's never as simple as that. It could be just the way they write descriptions and the way their vernacular, the choice of words, the way it flows. Okay. That pulls somebody in. But for me, in terms of this book that I'm writing, is goes back to that statement I said a little earlier, is, you know, write something only you can write.
Yes.
Okay. Like, when I write something, like I have a story about me going to India and kind of learning a little bit about who I am. Can other people that are Indian write that story? Maybe, but it's a much smaller pool than anyone in the world can write that story. Okay. But then when you get into the specifics of what happened to me on that journey, no one else can write that story.
Right.
Okay. And I'm the only one that can do it. But when I was developing it and I wrote it, you know, basically I outlined it first. From an emotional standpoint, it was very clear, but conceptually, I had no idea what I was trying to make. Mm-hmm. And eventually it became an Olympic skiing movie, which is basically a movie about me going to India and learning about who I am. But it's in my voice, okay? Because I experienced that. I know every second of that inside and out. No one else can write that. No one else can do that. And even, like I said, when I wrote that, you know, that Mickey Rooney movie.
Right.
It's about me dealing with the loss of my parent. My own grief, my own perspective, my own angle. And so I think a big part of finding out what your voice is understanding who you are and these incredible moments that have happened to you. Because, you know, at the end of the day, most of us have had basically the same experiences. We all had a first kiss. We all learned how to drive. We all went to school. We all had, you know, breakups and, you know, good friends and friends that we lost and bad. All these things are universal. Okay. But if I'm talking about it from my own personal unique experience with it, I'm writing it in my voice. And the more personal it is, the more universal it becomes and accessible by everybody. I'll give you a quick example. I wrote a movie about the duality of being Indian and American and growing up in a Western world, but inside my house was India, outside of my house was America. And I always struggled with, like, who's going to want to read this? And I was teaching in Arizona, and I was just using that as an example to my students, many of whom were first generation, you know, Hispanic. And they all related to it. And I realized, wait a second, it's just not limited to Indian people. That's what this country is built on, is immigrants. Okay. It relates to almost everyone in the country. And I was like, oh, okay. That's when I started realizing the more personal your story is, the more universal it is. And so the best ideas you have are within you. Yeah. Everyone's always looking outside for a news article to write about or something like that, which, you know, does work to some extent. But until you take that personal element within you and apply it to that, that's the magic combination.
That's beautiful. That's beautiful advice for screenwriters, is to honor that I've got something unique. I am, you know, others have walked on this road. Others will walk on this road. I'm maybe working in a genre that has 2000 versions already, but I'm writing it, and it's worth writing because my position on that road, my view, how I see and react to things is unique. And as you say, somehow that's a window for other people to see, you know, it's like them, but a little bit different. And there's some virtue to that, you know, this is not exactly my story. It's a metaphor for my story, my life. But there's something great about making it specific to someone, and then other people can find the general or the thing that relates to them.
Yeah, I think a lot of young students, young screenwriters don't realize that they have such great stories already within.
Right. Oh, yeah, absolutely. That they'll reach over to get some genre thing or some, you know, a great concept, high concept idea, and not realize that just their own biography, where they are, the questions that are on their mind right now, is a much better material to bake a good script cake.
Yeah, I used to think that they tell you write what you know whenever you're taking a screenwriting class. And I thought that meant I know what it's like to go to high school because I went to high school, and I know what it's like to, and you know, to a small extent, maybe it is, but I think it's more of write what you've learned.
That's good. That's good. Yeah, I can relate to that. I had the ambition to write a big historical epic, and I kept stopping myself because of that. Like, well, I didn't live in the 1600s, and I didn't sail around the world, and I didn't fight the Spanish Armada, and I know how am I daring to talk about these things? And then I realized my character has a very thorny relationship with his with the king or the queen at that time. And I realized that's very much like my relationship with my studio bosses and my frustrations with them and rebellion and kind of a love I had for them, love-hate relationship I had for them, was something I could just plow directly into the script. And make it live. So, you know, to wind these things up, I notice there is a kind of a thread through all this, which is the idea of connections, that you say that every element in your screenplay must be connected. And I totally agree with that. We've touched on it in a couple of ways already. What's your thought on that? That every element must be connected.
No, I think that a lot of times I'll read a feature from someone, and it's like three episodes of a TV show that have very little to do with each other.
Right.
Or sometimes even 10 or 15 episodes of like a small web series or something that just happens, and that's done. That's a complete story. Now this happens, and it's just these little tiny things because they don't really understand how to. And spread it out. Because when I was young, I used to think, how can I write 90 whole pages about this thing?
Yeah.
That just seems so daunting to me. And now my perspective is, how am I going to keep it to 90 to 100 pages? You know, I got so much more to say about it. And I think with experience and your evolution, you'll start to realize things that way. But it goes back to that notion of theme. It goes back to that notion of secret ingredient. It goes back to, you know, finding the one thing that you want to write about. So like one of the examples that I use, I break down a movie called Mr. and Mrs. Smith.
Right.
And one of the reasons I really like to use that, Simon Kinberg wrote that, is because he wrote it when he was in grad school. So he wasn't like some big time actor or big time writer and someone who was in the studio system at the time and super connected. He was somebody who was talking to a friend of his who was going through counseling. And the way the friend described the counseling to him, it came across like, wow, it's like they're going to war. And just that notion of the metaphor of a couple, like physically going to war, you know what I mean? Just kind of stuck with him, that visual. And so he conceptually came up with an idea. What if they were two people who were married together, were both assassins, but didn't know it?
Right.
Okay. So that's an entertaining concept. I'll go see that. But the truth in it is that they're lying to each other. And you know, you're a married man. If you continue to lie to each other about something, your marriage will come apart.
That's right.
And then as you're watching the movie, and, you know, as people who study and analyze movies and screenplays like you and I do, we probably watch stuff over and over and over again or read stuff over and over and over again, just trying to break it down to its smallest components. But then I started realizing there's a scene where they're fighting each other and then they get attacked by other people and they're killing the other people is in their house. And then they leave and the house explodes. And I'm like, in any other movie, that's a house exploding. In this one, it's a visual metaphor for their lives. They've literally destroyed their marriage.
And then
the very next scene, they break into the neighbor's house to steal a car. And I always ask students, what car should they steal? And it's always like a Ferrari, a BMW, a Mercedes. They stole a minivan. And the reason that they stole a minivan is because a minivan is the most connected vehicle to the idea of marriage that I can think about.
That's right.
Okay. And it's great sequences. Like, I love, there's one scene where he opens a side door and a guy jumps in and attacks him, and he punches him a few times and opens the other side door and throws him out. And he goes, these doors are convenient, which is a hilarious thing. But the whole reason that car exists is because of that emotional story that he's trying to tell, which is about marriage. And then when the movie ends, it ends in this huge home improvement store. Mm-hmm. I'm like, well, why does the movie end in a home improvement store? Because that's what the whole movie is about. It's about home improvement. And it has to end in the home improvement store. So taking that emotional idea of marriage is war and lying to each other, it helps you pick your vehicles. It helps you pick your locations.
Yes.
It helps you pick your explosions.
Absolutely.
So you have this through line throughout the entire thing. And you see it over and over and over again. Like, there's a movie, Toy Story 3 is a movie that I love. Another movie that made me cry. Please don't think I cry at every movie, because I don't. It's just the ones that we're talking about today. But it's a movie about abandonment, where the toys feel, you know, he doesn't play with them anymore, so they have to get rid of them. So he literally throws them in trash bags and puts them out in the hallway to go to the attic. Well, some people, sometimes you feel like you've been thrown in the trash by someone that you love. That hurts. Then the mom sees the trash bags and she goes and puts them on the curb. Well, when someone breaks up with you, you're getting kicked to the curb. These are all like visual manifestations of phrases and terms and thoughts and emotions that we've all had. And if that's not enough for you, the end of the movie occurs at a dump, because the kid toys feel like they're being dumped. So that's another example of visual writing. You're taking that emotional internal beat and you're externalizing it. And so they feel like they're being dumped. The whole scene takes place at a dump. That's visual writing.
Yeah.
Like, you don't have to do anything beyond that, and you're writing visually. Now, they had a lot of other cool stuff happen in that sequence as well. But across the board, Michael Arndt, by the way, is one of my favorite writers. He's just unbelievable. And so I'll watch a movie just if he writes it. You know, one of the few writers that, you know, a lot of times I'll watch a movie, it's a director attached to it, or if it's conceptually interesting, but anything he's going to do, I want to see. It's that taking that emotional beat and using that seed in every scene. Okay. And
you feel something at all those points you talk about, to be bagged up, to be put on the curb, to be kicked to the curb, to all those things, you automatically feel something. And what you're saying is so true. You know, I used to do consulting for Disney's Imagineering department, and I brought up this idea of theme, that you need a theme, you need to know what that is, so that it helps you answer these questions of where does it happen and how does it happen and what prop do they choose and all that. And one of the women designers raised her hand and she said, that is absolutely true in Imagineering. Until we know what the theme of the ride is, or the world that we're creating, we don't know what color to paint the wall. We don't know what fabric to put on the chair. We don't know what smells to bring in through the atmosphere. We don't know what music to play. We don't know anything, really, until we know this story is trying to evoke a particular emotion or feeling of adventure or horror or mystery or exploration or something that ties the whole thing together. And just to wind things up here, you quote the great Stephen Sondheim, that content dictates form. And I think that rides all the way through your script cake analysis of things. So what do you think about Sondheim's thought there?
Well, the interesting idea is that when he is or was given an assignment, he didn't want to be told, oh, it needs to be this pace, the song, or it needs to be in this genre, or it needs to be, you know, a pop song or a rock song or a ballad or whatever. He didn't want any of that. He just wanted to read what was going on and organically figure out contextually, what am I trying to say here? And then based upon that, you know, he would pick what type of music it is, which is like a genre, you know, and he would pick what the dialogue is. Like, he didn't want to be told it has to say this. And he had enough clout to where he's like, yeah, I'll just figure it out myself. And boy, did he figure it out over and over and over and over and over again. And I think that is, you know, if you were to extrapolate each one of the 10 points that I make, Mm-hmm. It probably all comes down to content dictates form.
Yeah. Yeah. I would say it this other way, that the needs of your story dictate the form of the story.
Right.
And so this odd thing, tracking back to the beginning of our discussion, that you do almost inevitably work in genres, and it seems like, am I not doing the same thing everybody else has done? But no, this is the challenge, and the fun of it is to find that unique way through a familiar landscape.
Absolutely.
And show us the backside of the building or the inside of a building that we've gone by many times, but we never looked in there, or we never knew why it was there in the landscape. So the opportunities are infinite for making variations within the well-known themes. And the audience participates in this because they know the story, you know, the basics of the genre and what to expect very well, sometimes better than we do. But our job is to surprise them with something new. And your book is all about that. I'm going to finish with a question I always like to ask people. Since you mentioned Toy Story, this is appropriate. What toys did you play with as a kid? And do you still play with them or play with some other kind of toy? What's up with the toy universe? Because that was so important to me and so much a driver of my interest in storytelling.
Well, I was a sports kid. Mm-hmm. So I was always outside with a basketball, tennis racket, football, things of that nature. In fact, when I direct the film, I get a football for each film. And at the end of it, all the cast and crew sign it. And, you know, in between scenes, we're tossing it. But in terms of toys, I was definitely into Hot Wheels. Mm-hmm. I had a lot of Hot Wheels, and I built a lot of ramps. And, you know, if Christmas came along and we got one of those things with the courses, we'd always be racing things. I remember one of my friends, his parents had those little plastic walking strips throughout their house so that they wouldn't ruin the carpet.
Uh-huh.
And we used to always like pick them up and put the Hot Wheels on top of them and race them and things like that. Lincoln Logs.
Oh yeah. I had those. Sure.
I loved Lincoln Logs. And I think that goes back to just kind of the core of my personality. I like to build things.
Yeah.
Stories being one of the things, but I also dabble in real estate, and, you know, I'm about to buy a car that I want to convert to electric, and I don't know anything about that. So I'm going to learn.
Wow.
And so the building, anything Legos that allows me to build and create. And I think that goes back to the core of who I am.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm there with you at the Lincoln Logs, and still have some. And, you know, they're wonderfully parallel to what goes on with screenwriting, because they only fit together a few ways. Mm-hmm. But within that, there's infinite possibilities.
Absolutely. And
I think that's where we're at. With your book, what's the subtitle of your book? That's always important. So it's Script Cake Secrets,
right? It's the top 10 mistakes novice screenwriters make and how to fix them.
And I think that's very important, because half your book, which we haven't really dealt with, is the answers. Because you not only diagnose these common ailments, but you also prescribe very precisely and very helpfully how people can work towards getting the best recipe together and having a successful outcome. So it's been great talking with you, Lavender. You are an inspiration to me and to many other people, and your career just keeps rolling along and bouncing in different ways unexpectedly. That's terrific, and I think there's a great, great future for you and your book. So thank you very much.
No, thank you, Chris, for taking the time. You've always been someone I've looked up to, and to have you agree to do this for me just means the world to me. Thank you so much.
That's great. You're welcome. Okay. All right. Trust the path, and just keep going till you get there.
Thank you so much for listening to the Script Cake Podcast. If you're interested in purchasing my book and reading it, Script Cake Secrets, Top 10 Mistakes Novice Screenwriters Make and How to Fix Them, it is available everywhere on October 18th, 2022. You can go pre-order it today, or you can order it on the 18th on Amazon.com, Barnes & Noble, and anywhere else. books are available. Thank you again for listening to this episode of the Script Cake Podcast. Until next time.